Is school reform making education better? Is it raising children up regardless of their background? Not according to the New York Times bestseller, Punished for Dreaming, How School Reform Harms Black Children and How We Heal, by Bettina L. Love. Bettina is a professor at Teachers College at Columbia University and the bestselling author of We Want to Do More Than Survive. In 2022, the Kennedy Center named Dr. Love one of the next 50 leaders making the world more inspired, inclusive, and compassionate. Here she is to share five of her big ideas.
Hi, I'm Bettina Love, author of the book Punished for Dreaming, How School Reform Harms Black Children and How We Heal. Have always wanted to write a book about the educational lives of my generation, 80s babies, the hip-hop generation, and how school reform labeled us disposable. This is our story. So from my new book, Punished for Dreaming, here are five insights from the book that illustrate the harm of educational reform. Insight one, educational reform is harmful to Black children. Punished for Dreaming is the story of the past 40 years of education reform, which deliberately crafted policies to punish Black people for believing in and fighting for their right to quality public education. The cruelest part of the so-called reform efforts that have shaped education in the past four decades is that they have relied on and taken advantage of Black people's aspirations, their hopes for education, self-determination, economic mobility, and ultimately, freedom. I was born just a scant 4 years before the release of A Nation at Risk, Reagan's administration report on the state of American education. The report was filled with alarmist language about the systematic failure of American schools to provide adequate education, coupled with this emphasis on reform as a solution, cast a long and dark shadow over young Black people of my generation. A Nation at Risk, together with Reagan's war on drugs, set in motion the merging of prisons and schools under the guise of getting tough on education. Getting tough was a euphemism for punishment, sold to public as high-stakes testing, school choice, vouchers, charter schools, and school safety. Police officers were placed in schools with metal detectors, police dogs, and surveillance equipment to control the students they now openly called thugs and criminals. Punishment became our primary solution. We were tough on crime and tough on public education. Under the slogans of school accountability and school safety, schools morphed into spaces of surveillance, confinement, and state-sanctioned violence to Black bodies. Schools became part of the police state, resembling prisons. 80s babies witnessed and, more importantly, experienced the joining of these industries, prisons and education, that expanded the prison industrial complex and created an educational system where Black children attended schools that structurally placed punishment, violence, police, standardized testing, and profits before learning. The conjoining of schools and prisons is not a conspiracy. This is not something you're going to find on the dark web. It is a well-executed plan that for the last 40 years has taken the lives of Black children with surgical precision. My life and the lives of my peers were forever shaped by coming of age in a generation whose government declared a war on them, not only in the streets, but also in the schools, at the intersection of economic gain and racist ideology. Insight two, Teach for America harms Black children. The education crisis manufactured by Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush created an entire job sector for educational entrepreneurs who hijacked public education using government funds. Teach for America is a prime example of an entrepreneur venture that used the unproven ideas of taking uncertified teachers and putting them in classrooms with students that need the most skilled teachers, ultimately sacrificing Black children's lives and education along the way. Princeton University senior Wendy Kamp stepped into the burgeoning field of education entrepreneurship by creating TFA. She secured $26,000 in funding from the philanthropic wing of the oil company Mobil, now known as ExxonMobil. From the start, she was bankrolled by corporate America and philanthropists. Kamp proposed enlisting college graduates from elite universities to teach for 2 years in urban schools, precisely the schools that white America had abandoned a few decades later. America's so-called brightest students with zero teaching experience would spend 2 years in an inner-city school, experimenting on Black children. These young and eager graduates were tasked with working in struggling schools that were designed to fail. That is to say, schools that were underfunded, had high teacher burnout, and administered tests that punished students. TFA recruits were given 2 years, if they could make it that long, to make a difference. Across the country, young do-getters, convinced that public schools needed them, flew into inner cities to save the day, creating networks of charter schools and taking up teaching jobs through TFA placements. All you needed was a college degree, a deep-seated belief that public education was a failure, and the hubris that you could fix Black education with no experience. Being a part of TFA looks great on the resumes of college graduates, but there's no conclusive evidence that TFA is effective at educating students. A 2002 study found that, unlike certified teachers, TFA teachers had a negative impact on students' outcomes. Renowned educational researcher and policy expert Linda Darling Hammond studied teachers and students in Houston and found that certified teachers, students consistently outperformed those taught by uncertified TFA teachers. Other studies have come to the same conclusions. Findings that new instructors are less effective than veteran teachers, and new teachers are least successful in their first 2 years. However, TFA ranks among the 100 largest nonprofits in the nation with an endowment of $280 million, over $245 million in awarded philanthropic grants, and $40 million received annually from the federal government as of 2016. TFA's overwhelming presence in urban schools fits a reform model that ensures Black students get a second-rate education. It is no secret that TFA teachers are rarely in suburban schools. We do not send uncredentialed teachers into white schools, or at least not middle and upper class ones. Also, those schools would never allow uncredentialed, inexperienced instructors to teach a largely white and well-off student body. Insight 3. In the U.S., Black people's lives are carceral. In reality, there is no school-to-prison pipeline. Black people's lives, regardless of location, are carceral. Schools are just another place where Black bodies are disciplined, tested, harmed, caged, and disposed of. Black people in this country, protection, safety, and freedom from carcerality are tangential, and at best, temporary, even within schools. At any time, the state can, with impunity, dispose of us. Black life, regardless of the setting, can be carceral. Punishment, disposability, testing, and being branded a threat by the state. I'll give you some examples. Driving is carceral, Sandra Bland. Sleeping is carceral, Breonna Taylor. Shopping is carceral, George Floyd. Playing in the park is carceral, Tamir Rice. Protecting trees is carceral, Bobby Wilson. Walking home is carceral, Trayvon Martin. Buying a home is carceral, Roy Thorne. Watering your neighbor's flowers is carceral, Pastor Michael Jennings. Exercising is carceral, Ahmaud Arbery. Calling the police for help is carceral, Michaela Bryan. Carcerality is inevitable because Blackness is often understood as synonymous with criminality. Therefore, we need to expand our understanding of carcerality beyond the walls of what we know as prisons and jails into all Black life living under white rage and anti-Blackness. Black life is consumed with desperately trying to escape carceral inevitability because we wear the presumption of dangerousness and guilt from the cradle to our premature graves. The tentacles of carcerality are always present in Black life, including at school. The best example I can give you of that is the DARE program. The DARE program, short for Drug Abuse Resistance Education, was created by Daryl Gates of the Los Angeles Police Department He was one of the most notorious and racist chiefs in the war on drugs. He once said that black people physiologically are different from normal people, which explained why black people who die when placed in the chokehold by police. Gates' extreme and widespread state-sanctioned violence towards black and brown communities sowed the seeds for the notorious 1992 police beating of Rodney King and the subsequent uprisings in the city. Gates' racist ideas and his approach to crime were disseminated throughout the country, reaching my childhood thousands of miles away, as Gates is one of the creators of the D.A.R.E. program. The D.A.R.E. program, implemented at my elementary school and many other schools, is now taught in all 50 states. By 1995, the program had been taught to more than 25 million elementary students. Tens of millions of kids across the country have experienced a police officer entering their schools to tell them to say no to drugs or else suffer the consequence of prison. Although countless studies have found D.A.R.E. to be ineffective, while others have found drug use higher among youth who completed D.A.R.E. than those who not enrolled in the program. It is the nation's single largest school-based prevention program in terms of federal funding. Insight 4, white philanthropy harms black children. Like the billionaire philanthropist who came before him, Bill Gates got into philanthropy out of self-interest. Gates needed to repair his image after Microsoft's antitrust trial in the late 1990s. Gates was seen as ruthless and predatory. During the trial, video showed Gates as arrogant and evasive. Rebranding himself as a social justice savior, Gates stepped down as CEO and contributed $20.3 billion to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation during the trial, making it the world's largest private charity. The foundation's strategic philanthropy is so well funded that it has come to serve as the power broker for wealthy engaging in what John D. Rockefeller III called venture philanthropy. The Gates Foundation, like those of the Kochs and the Waltons and the Boards, have great influence over public policy, public health, and public education, which in turn weakens our democracy, reduces civic life for the most vulnerable, and furthers the dismantling of the public sector, especially public education. What is astonishing about Bill and Melinda's record on education reform is that they have failed time and time again. Their foundation has spent billions of dollars in failed educational initiatives. According to the Washington Post, for years, Bill and Melinda Gates have spent a fortune trying to shape public education, successfully leveraging public funds to support their projects, but never having the kind of academic success they hoped for. For example, the Gates Foundation bankrolled Common Core movement that was popular during the early years of the Obama administration. The foundation spent $200 million and pulled significant political weight in convincing state governments to make costly systematic changes to state standards. Bill Gates himself played a leading role in revamping the country's teaching standards. He provided the money and operational structure to bring states together to work on standards. He also funded teacher unions, business organizations, and think tanks on both sides of the political aisle. Ultimately, those groups who routinely disagree on nearly everything accepted Gates' money and found common ground with Common Core. After more than 40 states signed on to Common Core and millions of Gates' money spent, the initiative fizzled out in 2019 as the conservative right made it a wedge issue, calling it a federal takeover of schools and state erosion of our civil liberties. The Gates Foundation subsequently released a 526-page report outlining failure after failure. In 2013, Bill Gates acknowledged the Common Core initiative was not a success. The Gates' candor is admirable, but it assumes that money aimed at improving education can bypass traditional public schools, years of community roots organizing, and the history and methods of Black educators, which is the solution. In the name of philanthropy, these foundations betray the egalitarian efforts of philanthropy. the sacrifices of Black children and pioneering Black educators who have fought for Black children. Insight 5, the call for educational reparations. After 250 years of enslavement, 90 years of Jim Crow, 60 years of separate but equal doctrine, 35 years of housing discrimination, and 40 years of education reform, the U.S. government owes a compound moral and financial debt to Black people. The answer is clear. It is time for educational reparations. Many scholars and activists and authors have called for reparations to help address the exploitation and oppression of Black people over the past four centuries. Few, however, have done so in the field of education. As I show in Punished for Dreaming, education reform removes the possibility of radically overhauling our education system. Reforms are used to keep Black progress at bay as reformers remove opportunity after opportunity, stripping our communities of public services and investments to strengthen communities and jobs, while at worst, killing and incarcerating us. Reform takes advantage of our hopes of living outside the conditions created for us. What is owed to Black children and their families who have been educated in a violent system dedicated to their deprivation? How can we end and repair the harm that has been done over the last 40 years? Public education, divests, and policies document our nation's commitment to anti-Blackness, providing a clear and concise roadmap to understanding how Black children, unlike their white peers, have been under-resourced, over-policed, over-tested, and deprived of educational opportunities with lifelong earning effects. As a nation, we must commit to ending education reform to move public education toward healing and transformation. Educational reparations is not about creating a better education system that will benefit only Black children. Every child would benefit from the hiring and retaining and overrepresentation of Black teachers and teachers of color. Schools must center healing and joy, multiple languages, religions, and abilities. Schools must work to sever educational ties to carcerality by replacing cops with counselors, therapists, social workers, and nurses. I'm not against testing, but we need to end high-stakes standardized testing and replace it with in-house tests that assist teachers in understanding the areas in which their students need more support. Reparations would fund well-resourced, state-of-the-art schools with curricula that honors different cultures and traditions with love and admiration, and where neurodivergent is welcome and celebrated. Schools that function in a thriving democracy don't track their students. They provide curricula to ensure that all students receive rich and engaging learning opportunities. Ultimately, reparations transform education for all children of all skin colors and all economic backgrounds. Working with a team of experts, we have determined that Black folks are owed upwards to $2 trillion for the last 40 years of education reform. The inspiration and research behind the call for reparations are detailed in Punished for Dreaming. We hope our work stands as a call of duty to start a conversation surrounding education reparations and move us closer to investing in Black education for America's future. I hope my book motivates you to learn more and take action. Thank you.
Thank you, Bettina. That was Bettina L. Love with 5 big ideas from Punished for Dreaming: How School Reform Harms Black Children and How We Heal. You might also want to check out our book bite for Seeing Others: How Recognition Works and How It Can Heal a Divided World by Michelle Lamont. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.